The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. On today's program, we have a little bit of everything, so much so that Sam said he has no idea where this program is going. None of the clips are connected together, he thinks, but we'll see if by the end there's a fair bit of continuity. Hopefully, there will be to the overall content. I think we've got some important news items to cover up front here in just a second. We'll also, if we have time, we'll talk some about social media, which is always an interesting subject to get into. And we'll even have some sports talk, some sports news on this particular episode of the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This last segment that we have planned for the end of the program, this is probably something Sam has been hoping for months. Our beloved producer has been, let's say he's been begging me to get into this particular subject. I might be exaggerating ever so slightly. But first, we'll start with some of the latest news items. Brad McDonald, you might have seen if you're a subscriber to the Trumpet Brief, our daily emails. If you don't subscribe to that, by the way, you can go to thetrumpet.com and receive those briefs, those newsletters, every single day in your mailbox, and we're getting quite a nice response to those daily emails, and not just in people responding to the email, but just the number of people who are opening those emails each day. We can monitor that with the software that we use to distribute all those emails, and it's quite exciting each day to see the thousands of people who are reading what we have to say. Brad McDonald has pitched in with some of those, and I think yesterday it was Richard Palmer, and I've put together a few, Joel Hilliker. So it's a team effort for sure, and we're doing everything that we can to make you aware of what is significant in the daily news cycle, and to make you aware of what's at thetrumpet.com. on any given day. Well, Brad McDonald wrote his Trumpet Brief on Tuesday, where he talked about Israel's Independence Day, its 69th birthday as a state. And Mr. McDonald talked about David Ben-Gurion's speech from back in May of 1948, broadcast live on radio from a secret location, just because of the dangerous neighborhood that this new state of Israel was situated in, less than 24 hours after Israel declared statehood. Little Israel was at war. Little Israel, without really even a standing army. And all of a sudden, it was going to war against Egypt, against Jordan, against Syria, Iraq, because all of these nations combined their forces to try to wipe out Israel right at the outset, right at the start, to destroy the little Israeli state. Well, Brad McDonald was, as it happens, he's in Jerusalem, or at least he was on Tuesday when he wrote this this Trumpet Brief. He was there for Israel's independence, not for that, but he was there on other business. But he saw some of the celebrations. He heard some of the celebrations. Lots of enthusiasm and excitement for Israelis on that day, much like July 4th for Americans. But as Brad McDonald wrote at the end of this Trumpet Brief, he said, how long can Israel remain independent in such a neighborhood? How long, when most of the international community supports, to some degree, the ambitions of Israel's enemies? How much longer does Israel have, given the support that so many nations in the international community give to Israel's enemies, enemies that want to, that still want to destroy Israel? He said in that trumpet brief Tuesday, Israel's independence truly is precarious. It truly is. And he urged readers to study up on what we have written about Jerusalem, the so-called city of peace. And yet, that's, as my father has said before, really, that that city is a powder keg. So many prophecies of God revolve around what happens right there in and around the city of Jerusalem. Well, following that that independence celebration, you had the much publicized meeting yesterday between President Donald Trump and the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas. And this first clip I'll play for you is President Trump talking about bringing peace to a very, well, a very difficult and troubled relationship between these two, the Israelis and the Palestinians. This is clip one.
It's a great honor to have President Abbas with us. We'll be having lunch together. We'll be discussing details of what has proven to be a very difficult situation between Israel and the Palestinians. And let's see if we can find the solution. It's a something that I think is frankly maybe not as difficult as people have thought over the years, but we need two willing parties. We believe Israel is willing. We believe you're willing. And if you both are willing, we're going to make a deal.
That's Donald Trump yesterday talking about yet another deal that he hopes to make or help make between the state of Israel and the Palestinian people. He admitted there up front that it's been a difficult situation, but then followed that up by saying that maybe not as difficult as people have thought over the years. We need two willing parties. Is that what he has? Two willing parties? Carolyn Glick gives some important background. Leading up to this meeting yesterday, she had a column, I think, about a week ago, anticipating this this meeting between Abbas and President Trump. She says here, this is from April 25th, in reality, an independent state of Palestine has existed for the past 12 years in Gaza. Rather than build that up and declare independence, Abbas and his comrades surrendered Gaza to Hamas in 2007. This is not ancient history. This is the last 12 years. I mean, we were actually living in Israel that summer of 2007. I believe it was in June when the Palestinian Authority, when Abbas surrendered Gaza to Hamas. Hamas was down there in the Gaza Strip throwing PLO members off of rooftops. It says Hamas, in turn, transformed independent Palestine into a base for jihad. Okay, this is history from the past 10 years. You have the Israelis that pulled out of the Gaza Strip entirely. They dragged their own people out, some 10,000 people. 10,000 Jews that were living in Gaza, that were living in the Gaza Strip, that we're farming, that we're employing Palestinians, whatever. And, I mean, everything was pulled out, and it was turned over. Every inch of it was turned over to the Palestinian people. But right away, there was like a civil war between the Palestinian people, and Abbas abandoned it. It says here, Abbas's failure to declare independence in 2005 and the subsequent failure of his U.S.-trained forces to defend their control over Gaza in June 2007. I mean, the U.S. helped them, trained their forces so that they could control Gaza once it was handed over to them. But they couldn't hold on to it because of the Hamas terrorists. She says here, it's critical that Trump understand the significance of his behavior before he meets with Abbas. It says, since the inception of the peace process between the Israel and the PLO in 1993, the professed goal of the PLO has been to establish an independent Palestinian state on any territory over which it was able to take control from Israel. That's what their goal has been since the beginning of the peace process in 1993. And 12 years ago, they were given all of the Gaza Strip. It says, yet 12 years ago, when Israel withdrew its citizens and military from Gaza, the PLO refused to take responsibility for this area, insisting ridiculously that Gaza was still controlled by Israel. So the Palestinians just kept right on lying, or at least the leadership. It said, well, we don't really have control. Israel might have pulled out, but you know, they're controlling what comes in and out of Gaza. So it's still kind of occupied. It says, then 10 years ago, U.S.-trained PLO forces fled to Israel rather than defend their control of Gaza when Hamas took up arms against them. People forget this history. Well, really, they don't even want to. They don't even want to be aware of this history. They just want to erase it. They just want to pretend that it didn't happen. It says there are, it seems, two main reasons for Abbas's behavior. The first is directly related to how he understood Israel's decision to withdraw. And then she gives some of the background. Ariel Sharon, a huge flip-flop, basically stunning the country. And it was ripping apart Israel there in the early 2000s. She says Israeli society was nearly torn apart. In the 1 year and 8 months between Sharon's surprise announcement and the expulsion of Gaza's Jews in August 2005, the media hemorrhaged with continuous propaganda that demonized the Israeli residents of Gaza and the religious Zionist community in general. So this is another insidious angle to this story as well. The fact that you had so many within Israel, so many in the major media, so full of self-loathing, self-hate, that they looked upon those that occupied those Jewish homes in Gaza as the real problem. The Israeli residents in Gaza, or the religious Zionist community. Carolyn Glick says here, a reminder of that toxic period came earlier this month when Haaretz published a column by veteran reporter Yossi Klein in which he alleged that religious Zionists posed a graver danger to the state of Israel than Hezbollah. So this is an Israeli journalist. He's writing for one of the most popular newspapers in Israel, if not the most popular paper. And he's talking about his own people posing a greater threat to Israel than Hezbollah, which wants to destroy Israel. And Hezbollah is not the only neighbor that wants that. How do you explain this kind of self-loathing, this level of self-hatred? It's not like it's limited to Israel. You see it here in the UK. You see it in the United States. You see it all across the latter-day descendants of Israel and Judah. Little Judah, of course, is the Israeli state there in the Middle East. But the descendants of ancient Israel, they're right here in the UK and in the United States. Last night in America, by the way, Katie Hopkins, she was on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News, and for those of you in the States, Hopkins is sort of like Britain's Ann Coulter. She's she's big on borders and security and exposing the threats coming upon Britain, and for that reason, she's a frequent target of the radical left here in the UK. And this is the exchange that she had with Tucker Carlson, clip 3.
So it's more offensive to the British ruling class and British authorities to be anti-Islam than it is to be anti-Britain.
Absolutely. You know, I know the tick list of correct answers that the liberal fascists want me to answer. I know what they'll approve of. I know what they like. And that's endless gushing sympathy for migrants, economic migrants, for the Islamic faith. You saw with the Westminster terror attack here, you know, the very first media that we had off of that was that we had to look out for our Muslim counterparts because they may be kind of under some kind of attacks following the terrorist attack on us. It's always that idea that we need to bow down to the culture that joins us, and we never seem to stand up for the culture they've chosen to join. And it's one of my big questions always is, if Islam is so fantastic, why do Muslims always seem to want to come to Christian countries? And it's a question that I never have got an answer to yet, Tucker.
That's Katie Holmes last night being interviewed on Fox News, talking about this sickness of self-hatred. I mean, it's one thing for the Islamists to blame Britain or to blame Israel or to blame the United States, and they do. But for the citizens of those states, Americans, Jews, the British, to blame themselves, self-hatred is a sickness. It's a sickness that's really bringing down our nations. The Bible talks about it in terms of our pride, the pride in our power being broken. And if you don't have that, power means nothing. If you don't have pride in your power, if you don't have pride in your history, your strength, what good is what little power might be left? How many people in Britain today know what it is that made them great? Or how many of them are aware of just how many miracles God performed to preserve our nations, to strengthen our nations? Look at little Israel. They're just basically declaring statehood. They have no real organized institutions to speak of. No standing army, and here all these nations come against them in 1948. And yet, miraculously, just like with so many accounts from World War II, our peoples were spared, were delivered. But you look at the self-loathing today, this broken pride, and really, like Leviticus 26:19 says, it's a curse. It's a curse from God. And you can read a lot more about that in Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Just to close the loop here on Britain, I thought I'd replay this clip by Melanie Phillips. Partly because it ties in with that one you just heard there, but also to just give another plug to Ms. Phillips, who will be speaking at Armstrong Auditorium this Sunday night, May 7th at 6 p.m., and hopefully the reaction in the crowd on Sunday night won't be quite like it was in this particular setting, this clip from a British talk show. I think this was a year or two ago, clip 4. That's Melanie Phillips trying to enlighten a British audience about the threat coming from the Islamic State of Iran. And she's shouted down. She's accused of being paranoid. Even Boris Johnson, there on the panel, you heard him speak up, saying that I agreed with what you were saying until you talked about neutralizing Iran. That's when you got a little crazy. And she stood up for the message that few are willing to proclaim, saying, how trivial of you. Look at what this nation is doing. Look at what they're saying. Look at what they're supporting. Look at what they're funding. Look at their charters. Look at what Mahmoud Abbas says on Palestinian TV. Who's paranoid? She's just there trying to speak up and tell the truth and gets shouted down for her efforts. Here again, the level of self-hatred, self-loathing. What a sickness. What a disease it is. What a curse. And you see it all over the place in modern-day Israel and Judah. CNS News had a piece yesterday about the new federal budget that we talked about with you, what was it, on Tuesday, I guess it was. Some 1,600 pages of spending, spending on this, spending on that, spending on just about everything, except for the border wall, except for security at the United States southern border. And, you know, we talked about the just the monstrosity that it is. And the Republicans so willing to just cave in on every point, basically. And then the Democrats celebrating, getting everything that they want, and preventing President Trump from getting some of his key, his signature items on the to-do list. It says here, the 1,665-page spending bill the Republican-controlled Congress is planning to pass this week includes multiple measures that seemingly demonstrate a commitment to securing the border in Libya, Ethiopia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Egypt, Jordan, and Lebanon. So there's nothing in there for the border, the wall at the southern border of the United States. In fact, there's an explicit statement saying that President Trump can't use any of this funding for a border wall. But there's plenty in there for the border security of Libya, Ethiopia, Pakistan, and all these other nations. It says the section that appropriates money for the global war on terrorism provides, and this is quoting the budget now, the United States budget, it says that these funds may be used to support the government of Jordan in such amounts as the Secretary of Defense may determine to enhance the ability of the armed forces of Jordan to increase or sustain security along its borders. So here is the U.S. Congress, well aware of how important it is for Jordan to secure its borders. But what about America's own borders? This author, or this journalist here at CNS says, imagine if the part of the bill that appropriates money for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security said that these funds may be used to support the government of the United States in such amounts as the Secretary of Homeland Security may determine to enhance the ability of the Border Patrol to increase or sustain security along the southwestern border of the United States by building impenetrable walls along the border. You can only imagine the kind of outrage that would come from the radical left. The radical left that routinely talks about any kind of effort to build up border security at America's southern border. They see it as immoral. It says, had Republicans included money, let me skip ahead a little bit. It says, of the funds appropriated by this act under the heading Foreign Military Financing Program, the bill says One point, well, that gets into some of the tedious details as well. Well, let me just play for you what Nancy Pelosi had to say. This is from, I think, a week or two ago on one of the Sunday morning talk shows. And this is her describing how immoral it would be for the U.S. to build up its border security.
The Democrats do not support the wall. And I think that the Republicans on the border states do not support the wall. The Republicans have the votes in the House and the Senate and the White House to keep government open. The burden to keep it open is on the Republicans. The wall is, in my view, immoral, expensive, unwise, and...
Immoral, expensive, unwise, and yet when it comes to Jordan, it makes perfect sense to these lawmakers. It says, while the this is back to that CNS story, while the Republican leadership would not appropriate the $1.4 billion needed to start the wall at the U.S.-Mexico border, it is appropriating $1.3 billion. Okay, so roughly the same amount for aid to Egypt. The bill even gives a special status to the part of this, the special status to the part of this aid Egypt will use to secure its border. So Egypt can use some of the funding coming from the U.S. budget spending to secure its border. Jordan as well. It says later on, 15% of these foreign aid dollars, the bill says, can be withheld from Egypt if the Secretary of State does not certify that Egypt's government is taking effective steps to advance democracy and human rights. It says, but even if the Secretary of State does not certify that Egypt is advancing democracy and human rights, it will not impact that part of the U.S. aid to Egypt that is aimed at improving Egyptian border security. It says, in the United States of America, the Bill of Rights still applies, but Congress has not ensured that our own border is secure. Well, I skipped ahead of some of the other quotes that it included there. But just think about, again, these statements coming from the hard left. They don't want to secure their own nation. They don't want to secure the borders of their own nation when they understand that right across the board, border security is critically important for these nations and other hotspots around the world. Well, there's quite a few people in our own nations, of course, that see our nations as the big problem. There's a lot of people in our own nations who want to see America step down, or Britain step down, or the Israeli state to step down, and soon they're going to have their wish. Look at the record of history. Even the greatest of nations, even the most powerful of empires, after peaking for what? Decades or maybe a few centuries in some cases? And then the inevitable slide into obscurity. We've talked about this quite often at thetrumpet.com over the last few years in the Trumpet magazine, how that superpowers die. And America's enemies, Britain's enemies, Judah's enemies, they're delighted by this trend. They love to see our nations bitterly divided. Imagine an audience, a British audience, cheering. Or, I guess not so much cheering, jeering. One lone voice that just talks about the threat that radical Islam poses. The CNS piece, it says, under the terms of the funding bill, U.S. taxpayer money will go to Ethiopia for border security and counterterrorism programs. It will go to the Lebanese Armed Forces to professionalize the LAF and to strengthen border security and combat terrorism, including training and equipping the LAF to secure Lebanon's borders. These are direct quotes from the spending bill. Border security all over the place, except for the United States. Except for the United States. It says, thanks to the deal that Republican and Democrat leaders made in Congress, it will not go to fund the border wall, President Trump vowed to voters he would build if he were elected. Over and again, the big, big, beautiful wall. That was the promise. And the president's finding that it's not going to be quite as easy as he said that it would be. Well, let's circle back to that Carolyn Glick article. Again, she's in anticipation of yesterday's meeting between President Abbas and President Trump. She's covering some important history here. She says here, Abbas and his lieutenants viewed the domestic chaos. This is Israel, divided, bitterly divided, back in 2003, 2004, when Sharon made the announcement, we're pulling out of Gaza. And there's Abbas, who's been in power for how many, 8, 9, 10 terms? That's a separate point, I guess. But there he is cheering. He's seeing Israel implode. If this was how Israelis reacted to the destruction of 21 communities in Gaza and 4 in northern Samaria and the dispossession of 10,000 Israelis, it was clear to Abbas and his comrades that Israeli society would collapse if Sharon carried out his plan to reenact the Gaza withdrawal tenfold in Judea and Samaria after the 2006 elections. Why accept Gaza if all of Israel was about to be destroyed by its own hand? See, the sickness from within. That's what the enemies see. They see our nations bitterly divided. Says the second reason that Abbas didn't declare independence in Gaza is because he had no interest in being held accountable for his behavior. Well, she goes on to talk about how that if he actually had to lead, then nations would begin to hold him responsible for how he led the Strip, the Gaza Strip, for how he governed over the people. And they'd probably look closer at how he uses all this international funding. Well, in any event, we now know the history. Israel withdrew in 2005. And Hamas grabbed hold of power in 2007. And Abbas just walked away from it all. It says Dan Pulitzer from Shalem College summarized in a recent article in the online magazine Mosaic his study of more than 400 public opinion surveys of the Palestinians in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. 400 surveys. From over the past 23 years, this is an author for Shalem College, summarizing the findings in this lengthy piece. And Carolyn Glick says here, like Abbas in 2005, the overwhelming majority of Palestinians believe Israel's existence isn't long or won't last that much longer in this world. She says, in one 2011 survey, for instance, a mere 23% of Palestinians said they were certain that Israel will continue to exist 25 years hence. Only 23% even believe that Israel will exist 25 years from now. 44% were certain it would not exist. They are certain, almost half of Palestinians are certain that Israel won't exist in 25 years. She says the fact that more than three-quarters of Palestinians are uncertain if Israel will survive is not only a function of Israel's own self-destructive behavior, it is premised as well on Palestinian ideology. It's a function of Israel's own self-destructive behavior, and it's also embedded in Palestinian ideology. Carolyn Glick says the vast majority of Palestinians reject Israel's right to exist. Indeed, a mere 12% of Palestinians believe that Jews have ties to the land of Israel. Only 12% even believe they have ties there. The vast majority, they reject Israel's right to exist. Now, in this press conference yesterday, you'll have to hear this through a translator, but listen to what Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas had to say. This is clip 2.
It's about time for Israel to end its occupation of our people and of our land. After 50 years, we are aspiring and want to achieve our freedom, our dignity, and our right to self-determination. And we also want for Israel to recognize the Palestinian state, just as the Palestinian people recognize the state of Israel.
Notice that last statement in particular. We want Israel to recognize us, the Palestinian state, just as the Palestinian people recognize the state of Israel. That's exactly the opposite of the truth. Based upon 400 public opinion surveys over the past 23 years, the vast majority of Palestinians reject Israel's right to exist. That's the truth. And yet for someone to proclaim that warning message, well, what would happen? I suppose it would be a similar reaction in Judah like it was for Melanie Phillips a couple of years ago when warning about Iran. You just get shouted down. And you can see the attitude. You can see the self-destructive behavior in the editorials coming out of Haaretz. Yeah, the Zionist Jews, they're a greater threat to our own nation than Hezbollah. Did you know that? That's in a major mainstream newspaper in Israel. An Israeli paper. As Carolyn Glick points out, 69 years ago, the Jews established our state. A Palestinian state was not established then or since, not because Israel was unwilling for such a state to come into being, but because the Palestinians refused to accept Israel's right to exist. That's why there's no Palestinian state. They've had every opportunity. And as she brings out in her column, for the past 12 years, they've had their own Palestinian state. It's in the Gaza Strip, and look at what they're doing. Look at what the Hamas leadership is doing with the people there. A Palestinian state was not established, and it could have been. It could have been early on. It could have been along the way. Finally, it says here, she refers to this fellow that did the study for Shalem College. Pulsar showed that whereas a plurality to a bare majority of Palestinians accepts the premise of a two-state solution, the overwhelming majority reject any deal that would leave Israel intact as a viable state capable of defending itself. Equally importantly, 68% of Palestinians believe that even if a Palestinian state is established in Gaza, Judea, and Samaria, with Jerusalem as its capital, they should continue to aspire to Israel's destruction. In other words, she concludes, even if the PLO signs a deal with Israel that says the conflict has been resolved, for 68% of Palestinians, the conflict will continue. They oppose ending the education of their children to seek Israel's destruction and accepting Israel as a peaceful neighbor. That's the truth of it. And yet there's a lot of people, perhaps even a majority, if not a majority, around half in Israel, that totally reject Carolyn Glick's message, the findings from those 400 public opinion surveys that stretch for 23 years. They just simply reject it and would presumably shout down the messenger with claims of paranoia. Well, we'll see how it plays out. As you know from prophecy, I'll just take you back to what Brad McDonald suggested you do in that trumpet brief from Tuesday, Jerusalem in prophecy, the King of the South booklets. I mentioned the United States and Britain in prophecy. It's important for us to know what the Bible says about what's coming upon our peoples from without and what's happening to our nations from within. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can email the program at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG, 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
There is a piece in, I believe it was today's New York Times, about Facebook, the social media site that now has nearly 2 billion users. That's crazy. All over the world. But the leaders there, or the business behind the social media site, they're scrambling to try to police the content, which, if you've seen some stories of late, particularly with the live broadcasting that you can now do on Facebook, some people are taking it upon themselves to broadcast crimes like murder and rape right there on live television or a live broadcast that goes all over the world. It says here, earlier Wednesday, Mark Zuckerberg, the company's chief executive, acknowledged the problem. In a Facebook post, he said that over the next year, the company would add 3,000 people to the team that polices the site for inappropriate or offensive content, especially in the live videos the company is encouraging users to broadcast. So on the one hand, the company is all for it. They're encouraging it. More and more of these live broadcasts. We've got to get into them. We've got to make them, we've got to have them appear right up high in the timeline. But then it says here, this is quoting Zuckerberg, if we're going to build a safe community, we need to respond quickly. We're working to make these videos easier to report so we can take the right action sooner. So basically to get more policing so that they can pull those broadcasts down or those posts down as quickly as possible. It says the announcement comes after Facebook Live, the company's popular video streaming service, was used to broadcast a series of horrible acts to viewers, including a man boasting about his apparently random killing of a Cleveland man and the murder of an infant in Thailand. The company, it says, is trying to strike a balance between censorship and free speech. Facebook video has been used to share millions of personal stories and to document events of immense public interest, such as a series of police shootings of unarmed black men that sparked a national conversation about race and law enforcement. Although there is little question that live-streamed murder does not belong on the service, the company has come under fire when it has stopped violent broadcasts, it gives examples of police shootings. So they're struggling. You know, what do we show? What's appropriate? What isn't appropriate? We need more policing. And meanwhile, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. 2 billion people actively using the service. And it brings to mind what Herbert Armstrong so often said, that with the explosion of knowledge, with the explosion of technology and information, you have this corresponding explosion of evil and violence. Read about how it was before the flood in Genesis 6. What man's mind was set on continually. Or go back and study that section in Genesis 11 about the Tower of Babel, where God had to intervene because, as it says there in Genesis 11 and verse 6, if he didn't intervene, nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. I mean, if I don't intervene to slow this down, they're going to destroy themselves. Let me read to you what the JFB commentary says about that passage in Genesis 11. JFB says, "They will shrink from nothing, however hard or presumptuous, which they may wish to accomplish, so that the evil already in the world will be fearfully increased, and its diffusion accelerated by this ungodly association, unless means are taken for its immediate dissolution." God had to take action because the evil already in the world was about to fearfully increase, as JFB brings out. Now you think about what Paul prophesied in 2 Timothy chapter 3, where he says this in the last days, it's going to be dangerous. You're going to have all of these people who love themselves, who covet, who boast, they're blasphemers and so on, without even natural affection. He says in 2 Timothy 3:7, "Ever learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth." And then verse 13 is the one I want to draw attention to. "But evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse." And that's what you see. All of this increase in technology and advancement. And at the same time, the evil that's already in the world and that's actually getting worse is going to be fearfully increased and spread over all the earth. Its diffusion accelerated thanks to technology, the same technology that, well, in the case of God's work, we make use of. It's a marvelous work, a wondrous work in so many ways. What we can do from a little cellar underneath a large home, a broadcast that can go out all over the world through live streaming technology. And yet look at how many people can also spread the message of evil, and look at what's so much more popular as well than the dissemination of God's truth. It's exactly as JFB said about that period, the Tower of Babel period, the evil in this world fearfully increasing. It's the paradox that Herbert Armstrong spoke of. All of this progress, quote unquote, all of this technology, all of this advancement, and yet at the same time you have these appalling evils. Mr. Armstrong wrote in The Plain Truth back in 1970, "What is wrong?" He says this is an article about education, how education hasn't solved the problems of this world. It says, "Is it wrong to acquire or possess knowledge? No, but there are two kinds of knowledge, true and false, right and wrong, good and evil. In pursuit of knowledge, man has used one source, the scientific method of experimentation, discovery, and reason." That's been the only source in man's pursuit of knowledge. And I mean, admittedly, there's some pretty phenomenal inventions out there, technologies, advancements that are available. And yet what's missing? Spiritual knowledge. God's truth. Revelation from God. And man's been cut off from that, in fact. I won't take the time to go back through Genesis 2. and Genesis 3. But that's the foundation. Mr. Armstrong said errors almost always come from a false basic premise. Well, go back and study Genesis 2 and 3. Or study it along with what Mr. Armstrong wrote about in The Missing Dimension and Sex, those first few chapters in particular. And you see what's wrong. You see what the problem is. You see the knowledge, the education that man lacks. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, as promised, we'll have a bit of sports news for you. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Here's the 0-1. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs, what the World Series! Bryant makes the play! It's over! And the Cubs have finally won it all! 8-7-10!
You heard it here first. On the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, the Cubs won the World Series. Well, maybe we weren't first with that. But for this program, this is our first coverage of the Cubs' first World Series in, what, over 100 years, I think it was. Sam, a native Chicagoan. I believe you stayed up late over here in the UK to watch that game, yes? Where was I? You asked me about watching it. I didn't watch it. I didn't watch any of that series, but I did read a little bit about it. And I didn't plan on saying anything about it on the radio until I saw this article yesterday. Interesting story. I don't know why I get Fortune magazine, but in any event, I got a stack of mail from my Edmond address, my Oklahoma address. It came in the mail yesterday here to Edstone. And in this box of mostly junk mail, there's a Fortune magazine from April 1st. This is old news on the World Series, old news from Fortune. I mean, this is several weeks ago. And it says here, the world's 50 greatest leaders. And first on the list is a guy by the name of Theo Epstein. And as it happens, he's the general manager of the Cubs. Used to be with the Boston Red Sox, this article. I was reading this last night when my kids were at dance. And this article talks about in the last year he was with the Red Sox, how that there was so much squabbling and so many egos and infighting that the Red Sox coming up to the playoffs had this huge lead and they squandered it. They lost out on their opportunity to go to the playoffs, I think it was. And so then, he makes a break in his career, moves over to the Cubs. And this article says here, a few weeks before spring training of 2012 in the ballroom of a budget hotel in Mesa, Arizona, Theo Epstein stood before nearly every person connected with the baseball operations of the Chicago Cubs and told them how the Cubs were going to win the World Series. Sam just put a picture of Mr. Epstein on my monitor. So there you go. Epstein devoted the first 3 days of the sessions to on-field strategy, hitting philosophy, pitching philosophy, defense, and base running. But the entire last day was devoted to character. The Cubs, Epstein insisted, would acquire only players with outstanding makeup or only players with outstanding character. It says later on, Epstein gave his scouts very specific marching orders on every prospect. He wanted the area scout to give 3 examples of how that player responded to adversity on the field and 3 examples of how that player responded to adversity off the field. They were to dig into the player's makeup by talking to just about anybody who knew him. Parents, guidance counselors, teammates, girlfriends, siblings. He wanted as many questions answered as possible. What's the family situation like? How does he treat people when no one's looking? What do his friends say about him? What do his enemies say about him? How does he treat people he doesn't necessarily have to treat well? What motivates him? Is he externally motivated where he wants money or followers? It says Cubs scouting reports would never look the same again. Epstein wanted reports that went on for pages, like the Russian novels his father had him read when he was a boy. It says the scouts who didn't take to the long-form scouting reports didn't last. Epstein ran them off. It wasn't hard, measurable data, but it was information nonetheless. And if Epstein was going to build a team around high-character, high-impact position players, he wanted as much of it as possible. I thought that was just an awesome article about a general manager putting together a team and understanding that in addition to all of the analytics for, you know, batting averages and slugging percentage and all these other things I don't even understand, character counts as well. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us. You can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you again tomorrow.